The mission is persuasion. The usefulness of the super wasn't the issue. The willingness to build it was. And that sort of logic would guide the nuclear arms race for the next 40 years. The debate over the hydrogen bomb strengthened the influence of the military in nuclear weapons policy, diminished the stature of the Atomic Energy Commission, and created a lasting bitterness among many of the scientists and physicists who'd served in the Manhattan Project. But all the passionate arguments about genocide and morality and the fate of mankind proved irrelevant. The Soviet Union had secretly been working on a hydrogen bomb since at least 1948. According to the physicist Andrei Sakharov, considered the father of the Soviet H-bomb, Joseph Stalin was determined to have such a weapon, regardless of what the United States did. Any U.S. move toward abandoning or suspending work on a thermonuclear weapon would have been perceived either as a cunning, deceitful maneuver or as evidence of stupidity or weakness, Sakharov wrote in his memoirs. In any case, the Soviet reaction would have been the same: to avoid a possible trap and to exploit the adversary's folly. 2 weeks after North Korean troops crossed the border and invaded South Korea, President Truman approved the transfer of 89 atomic bombs to American air bases in Great Britain. The Joint Chiefs of Staff feared that the outbreak of war in Korea might be a prelude to a Soviet invasion of Western Europe. The Atomic Energy Commission readily agreed to hand over the bombs, minus one crucial component, the nuclear cores. They remained at storage facilities in the United States, ready to be airlifted overseas if war seemed imminent. The Department of Defense was still pushing hard for custody of America's nuclear arsenal. General Kenneth D. Nichols, head of the Armed Forces Special Weapons Project, asserted that the military should not only control the atomic bombs, but also design and manufacture them. Frustrated that so many Los Alamos scientists had opposed the super, Edward Teller sought the creation of a new weapons laboratory, backed by the Air Force, in Boulder, Colorado. The AEC fought against those proposals while recognizing the need for military readiness. In August 1950, Truman approved the transfer of 15 atomic bombs without cores to the Coral Sea, an aircraft carrier heading to the Mediterranean. The Air Force didn't like the precedent and insisted that in the future, all nuclear weapons stored on carriers should be under the formal control of the Strategic Air Command, not the Navy. The following year, as UN troops battled the Chinese army in Korea, the Air Force finally gained custody of atomic bombs and their nuclear cores. Allowing the military to have possession of them seemed at the time to be a momentous step. General Hoyt Vandenberg, the Air Force Chief of Staff, assumed personal responsibility for the 9 weapons. They were shipped to an air base in Guam, ready for use, if necessary, against the Chinese. By the end of 1950, the United States had about 300 atomic bombs, and more than one-third of them were stored without nuclear cores on aircraft carriers or at air bases overseas. The rest were kept at the AEC's American storage sites, ostensibly under civilian control. And yet, that custody, required by the Atomic Energy Act, had in many respects become a legal fiction. For example, at Site Baker, the storage facility in Killeen, Texas, the AEC had 11 employees, and the military had 500, including all 200 security personnel. The storage sites were well defended against saboteurs and intruders, but not against every kind of unauthorized use. General LeMay later admitted that special arrangements had been made at Site Able, the facility in the Manzano Mountains near Sandia. Our troops guarded the atomic bombs, but we didn't own them. Civilian controlled completely. I remember sending somebody out to have a talk with this guy with the key. I felt that under certain conditions, say we woke up some morning and there wasn't any Washington or something, I was going to take the bombs. I got no static from this man. I never had to do it or anything, but we had an understanding. The arrangement seemed necessary, given the rudimentary nature of command and control in those days. If I were on my own and half the country was destroyed and I could get no orders and so forth, LeMay explained, I wasn't going to sit there fat, dumb, and happy and do nothing. Work on the hydrogen bomb gained more urgency after it became clear that the Soviet Union was trying to build one. A few days after Truman's announcement that the United States would develop the super, the British physicist Klaus Fuchs confessed to having spied for the Soviets. At Los Alamos, Fuchs had worked on the original design of the implosion bomb and conducted some of the early research on thermonuclear weapons. In January 1951, despite a year of intense effort, American scientists were no closer to creating a hydrogen bomb. Teller had proposed using a fission device to initiate the process of fusion, but he could not figure out how to contain the thermonuclear reaction long enough to produce a significant yield. The mathematician Stanislav Ulam suggested a couple of new ideas. The hydrogen fuel should be compressed before being ignited, and the detonation of the bomb should unfold in stages. Teller was greatly inspired by Ulam's suggestions, and in March 1951, the two men submitted a paper at Los Alamos that laid out the basic workings of a thermonuclear weapon. On heterocatalytic detonations 1, hydrodynamic lenses and radiation mirrors. And then they applied for a patent on their H-bomb design. Ulam had called his initial proposal a bomb in a box. The Teller-Ulam design that emerged from it essentially placed two fission bombs in a box, along with hydrogen isotopes like deuterium and tritium to serve as thermonuclear fuel. Here is what would happen if everything worked as planned. An implosion device would detonate inside a thick metal canister lined with lead. The X-rays emitted by that explosion would be channeled down the canister toward hydrogen fuel wrapped around a uranium-235 spark plug. The fuel and the spark plug would be encased in a cylindrical layer of uranium-238, like beer inside a keg. The X-rays would compress the uranium casing and the hydrogen fuel. That compression would make the fuel incredibly dense, and then would detonate the uranium spark plug in the middle of it. Trapped between two nuclear explosions, the first one pressing inward, the second one now pushing outward,